Okay, before we get too far into today's episode, I got some exciting news to share. We've officially launched a website where you'll discover a hub for all things Star Wars. From the latest news to exclusive merchandise. And here's the best part. For just $5 a month, you can join our membership program to access all of our episodes completely ad-free and all new episodes a few days earlier. But that's not all. Our members enjoy a treasure trove of content that'll never hit the airwaves of this show, including special episodes, full audio comics, and books. So if you're craving extra content or eager to listen to an episode early without interruptions or simply just want to grab a Sway t-shirt, head over to www.swaypodcast.com. That's SWAAPODCAST.com. Don't miss out on your chance for exclusive content and so much more.
What role do you have?
You are now tuned in to Talk to Sway. So just sat back and I'm ready to play. Let me take your thoughts far, far away. Now let's hear what Darth Vader has to say.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Hey everyone, Kyle here. And guess what? You're listening to the best Star Wars show in the galaxy, Star Wars Audio Archives. If you thought Episode 3 of Into the Dark was good, then you haven't heard nothing yet. And I think you better buckle up, because we're not just stepping into Part 4. We're jumping in with both feet this time around. It's like we're right in the middle of all the action, with mysteries that'll make your head spin. So go to your favorite spot to chill, maybe grab you a snack or two, and let's dive into Episode 4 together. Are you ready? Then let's go.
Affy hadn't realized anything was amiss until she was smack in the middle of it. Duck! Wreath shouted. She didn't ask why, didn't turn to look, just dropped to the walkway floor. A metal bar whizzed overhead, slamming into the wall with a reverberating bang. Covering her head, she scurried along until she could push herself behind a barrier of leaves. Maybe it had been a counter once, or a bar. Now, thickly tangled with vines, it had become a hedge. Either way, it would hide her from the looters. Why hadn't she waited longer to come back down? Too late for regrets. She was determined to remain low. If she was revealed, they might attack her, seeing her as competition for the few precious goods on the station. Or, if they wanted to gamble on overpowering the vessel, a pretty safe bet, and a quick clearing of the hyperspace lanes, it was possible they'd steal Affy herself. The Republic banned slavery, but she wasn't sure they were in the Republic at the moment. She didn't put it past some of the thugs to make a quick profit by selling her off to someone who'd whisk her over the border. So, she thought, breathing hard, let's lay low. From her vantage point, Affy could peer through the leaves at the fracas. Already, the Arinkans were ripping through vines on the ground level, tearing a hole that would allow them to rummage through anything hidden beneath. Farther up the atrium, two levels above her, the Mezi had dug out something that looked like a Maxine armor. That stuff never rusted or wore out. It was worth thousands. The Arinkans would be furious when they saw that their rivals had found such a prize. Furious enough, probably, to start a fight about it. Affy cast an appraising look upward at the wall. Sculver says that back in the day, older space stations used to magnetically seal their entire hulls. If they did that here, just one blaster bolt could ricochet around the station for minutes, for hours even. The Arinkans didn't give a damn about history or anything else besides their own porcine skins, so they wouldn't realize the danger. If a fight broke out, they'd fire off so many bolts that the entire station would turn into a death trap. Where was Wreath? His voice had come from below, but she couldn't see much of the station's airlock ring. Were the other Jedi coming to help him? Could they help? Affy had yet to be much impressed by these feigned mystical warriors, who as far as she could tell had mostly preached at them before dumping them on an ancient station that was a whole lot of bad luck. Affy's brief reverie was shattered when heavy-booted footsteps began thudding against the floor panels near her. An Arinkan? Her glance through the leaves revealed a red-scarved human instead, but one whose greedy, callous smile would have looked at home on an Arinkan's snout. Pricey market out there for little girls, he said in a sing-song. These ones aren't too old. Did he mean for her to hear him? Instinct told Affy that he wasn't a slaver. His interests seemed more personal, and even more ominous. Less like she was something he could sell, more like she was something he couldn't afford to buy. Slowly, slowly, so as not to rustle her clothing or disturb even one leaf, Affy reached for the blaster strapped to her side. It slipped silently free of its holster. Yeah, firing into the hull could kill us all, she thought. But only if I miss. I won't miss. Affy looked through her blaster's sights, aiming them square at the man in the red scarf. If he turned even a fraction of a centimeter in her direction, he'd see her. That is, if he had time to see her before dying, which Affy didn't intend to give him. But he didn't turn. Instead, he began to cackle. Yes, yes, he called, probably to one of his shipmates. That one will do nicely. He jogged away. Affy felt relieved, more than she should. She'd never killed anyone before, and hadn't wanted to begin. If it's your life on the line, she scolded herself. You shouldn't think about that. You shouldn't think about anything but saving your own life. Easier said than done. Then a shriek echoed through the station. Affy couldn't see who had cried out, but she already knew. They'd taken Nan. Reith looked around wildly, trying to identify the ringleaders. If he could take out one or two key players, that might well pacify the others. A voice shattered his concentration. Reith! Help! Orla Jereni struggled through the jungle of the exposed atrium, half-supporting a staggering Master Komak. Anyone on an upper level would have a clear shot. Reith hurried to help them reach the tunnel that led to the airlock ring. Just as the three of them arrived at the tunnel, Dez Rydan dashed out, lightsaber in his hands, cloak billowing behind him. He went to help support Master Komak, but the older Jedi had already begun to rally. What happened? Dez asked. He had a collapse. I think we both did, said Orla. Or we both had an experience, one I can't easily explain, but it's rooted in the dark side. Of that, you can be sure. The station atrium echoed with shouts, bellows, and the clanging of metal. Master Komak nodded quickly as he righted himself. Orla, are you able to find her? Her hand went to the lightsaber at her belt. Always. Master Komak glanced at Reith, who gave him a quick nod. Then the four of them rushed back into the station.
Orla, take these!
Master Komak called, pointing at the second level up.
I'll clear the top levels. Dez, head to the far side of the station and see what's happening there. Reith, guard the airlocks.
Reith nodded. Orla and Master Komak jumped at the same instant, both of them soaring meters high. Reith didn't watch them any longer than that. Instead, he ignited his lightsaber. It had been a while since he'd felt its hum, since its cool green light had bathed him in its glow. But for someone who considered himself much more scholar than fighter, it felt surprisingly good to have the lightsaber in hand again. A shriek drew his attention to a struggle taking place near another entrance to the airlock ring. Reith's eyes widened as he saw Nan in the grip of an enormous human man. Her arms were pinned to her sides, and though she thrashed her head from side to side, it was impossible for her to escape. She looked more furious than frightened, though she had to be terrified.
Hag! Nan cried out. Hag, help!
She had no one she trusted in the whole galaxy to take care of her, except one elderly man. Reith didn't doubt that Hag would hobble out there, ready to pummel her kidnapper with his cane, nor did he doubt that Hag would quickly be beaten or killed for his trouble. Reith ran several steps toward them, then jumped. His leap took him 5 meters over the grass, through vines that smacked against his limbs, to a point directly in front of Nan and her would-be abductor. Both of them looked equally astonished to see him. Another human, one wearing a red scarf, swaggered up behind him. You here to tell us we're not being orderly? He said in a mocking voice. No law in these parts yet, little boy. That means we can take as much off this station as we can carry. And we can carry her just fine.
Nan's eyes were wide.
Wreath, what are you?
She lost her breath and could only stare at the lightsaber in disbelief. He ran the scenarios in his head. There weren't many. All of them were more violent than he would prefer. Wreath said evenly,
Put her down and walk away, or I'll be forced to take action.
What? You think you could take both of us out with your little twinkle sword?
Sneered the thug, still clutching Nan in a death grip.
Looks like a toy.
It's not,
Wreath said quietly, putting power and intent into his words.
Put her down and walk away.
But like all his other attempts so far at using the Force to change minds, this failed. The red-scarved man swaggered forward, hands on his hips.
Do your worst, little boy.
Never before had Wreath been in this position, where he would have to be the first to take action, to do harm. He'd always wondered if he would hesitate, if he'd doubt himself. When it came to saving a life, however, there could be no hesitation. Instead, Wreath said,
I understand prosthetic arms are more advanced than prosthetic legs. More comfortable, too.
No flicker of understanding showed in the man's face. Not until the moment after Wraith's lightsaber had swept through his arms, severing it at the elbow. A forearm tumbled down onto the ground. The red-scarved man's expression shifted from smugness to disbelief, then crumbled into a grimace as his shocked nerve endings finally broadcast pain. Immediately, the bigger guy dropped Nan and ran into the shadowy jungle surrounding them. Nan put her hand to her mouth as she stared at the abandoned forearm. Wreath said,
I have to stand guard at the airlocks. Come with me.
The red scarf man finally fell to his knees and howled.
What have you done to me?
Wreath holstered his lightsaber.
We'll give you a full medical checkup as soon as the situation calms down.
With that, he pulled Nan against his side. He wasn't sure how to balance himself for the leap while carrying someone else, so he recalculated swiftly.
Hang on.
Her arms went around his neck. Wreath jumped forward and upward in a sharp arc until his free hand clutched one of the longest vines. Their momentum and weight did the rest, sending them swinging in a long curve back to the airlock ring. No sooner had they landed than Nan dashed toward the lock where her ship and Hag awaited. Of course, she'd want to find her guardian, but she glanced back over her shoulder and called out,
Thanks!
Wreath managed a brief smile for her before he took up his lightsaber again. The Arrancans leveled their blasters at Komak as he leapt onto their deck of the station.
Magnetically sealed?
He wondered of the station.
Possibly.
The blue blade of his lightsaber ignited, its gleam slicing through the murky dark. As the Arrancans fired, he spun his saber, expertly deflecting the beams into the trunks of the larger trees that could bear it, or into some of the boxes and trunks of abandoned cargo. None hit the walls, which was his main objective. Squealing in consternation, the Arrancans beat a hasty retreat. He glanced down just in time to see Orla hold out her lightsaber and ignite. Two blades, shining white, piercing the shadows. The Mizzy began backing off immediately, but it was too easy for the looters to escape. The layout of the station meant he and Orla would literally be running in circles trying to pursue them all. The vessel lacked the military heft to forcibly stop the looters from leaving with their ill-gotten gains. Therefore, stopping the ransacking would have to be accomplished through more than sheer strength. Reason and persuasion hadn't worked either. Time for awe. Komak climbed the rungs of the atrium railing. His eyes detected Affy Hollow, cleverly concealed behind a greenery-overgrown barrier. But that hardly mattered, except that this girl, too, would finally learn what the Jedi truly were.
He focused his energy and drew upon the Force. Though darkness surrounded him, the sheer vitality of the living things on the station worked on Komak like fuel. Strength flooded his body, and ultimate clarity sharpened his mind. With that, he jumped. Affy screamed, but the sound flowed past Komak, just one more aspect of the illusion reality around him. Reaching out with the Force, he sensed the atrium floor and balanced himself above it, 8 meters above it. Levitation was a complex art. The more academic masters bickered over the reasons why it should be more difficult for Jedi Knights to lift and steady themselves than any other object. Komak considered the discussion academic to the point of esoteric. Besides, this was a skill that for him came naturally. As he floated in the center of the atrium, he held his lightsaber above his head. Its blue glow flickered against the exposed slivers of metal as though igniting dozens of small flames. He called out, "Hear me!" His voice echoed throughout the atrium, as Komak had calculated it would. The sounds of combat slowed, then silenced. Faces of many species stared out, weapons at their sides slack in astonishment at seeing a human male airborne, held aloft by no power but his own. Really, it was among the least significant of a Jedi's abilities, but it made people pay attention and earn their respect, which was all Komak required at the moment.
"In the name of the Republic, I command you to cease looting and thievery aboard this station immediately."
Komak's resonant voice filled the entire vast space, reaching every antenna and ear.
"Within 15 minutes, every captain of every ship now docked here must have done one of two things: packed up their crew and left, or prepared themselves to peaceably cooperate. You accept the authority of the Republic's laws and stay, or you reject it and leave. It doesn't matter which, but choose one now, or we will be forced to make that choice for you."
Nobody hurried to leave. Instead, many of the groups collected themselves, put down the finds they'd stolen, and began shuffling back toward the airlock level. They'd be ready to negotiate. He and the other Jedi would have a chance to discuss the strange phenomenon emanating from the idols, so strongly linked to the dark side. But Komak didn't fool himself that he'd achieved anything more than a temporary reprieve. As he descended through the air, rogue rippling around him, he knew this fragile peace would not last long. 25 years earlier, part 2. Smoke in his nostrils, roaring in his ears, blood on his tongue. Last to come clear, faint swirling light clouded with dust that stung his eyes. Komak sat up amid the wreckage of their craft and took stock of the situation. The ship remained more or less intact, which he knew because the temperature remained constant. Through the viewport, he could see the planetoid's surface, salt-crusted, small crystals glittering in the howling winds. They'd made landfall on the slope of a hill, it seemed, because the entire ship tilted perilously to one side. Deep scrapes the ship had left in the surface revealed dark green stone beneath, buried in centimeters of salt. "I must find Master Simix," he thought. That was his most important responsibility, but that didn't mean he could ignore those closer to hand. Next to him, Orla leaned forward, bracing her hands against the pilot's console. Her breaths came shallow and fast.
"Orla," Komak managed to say, "are you all right?"
"Yes."
She sounded as if she wasn't completely sure. Komak reached out with a Force to find the other two passengers. Master Lerit Sovereign came clear to him almost instantly. She'd moved away from the cockpit, in pain but focused, and yet her spirit was suffused with sorrow.
Where Master Simix should have been, where his calm, powerful centeredness in the Force had always been, Komek found nothing.
Master Simix!
He called, willing himself not to know what the Force had already told him. For the first time in his life, he pushed the Force away, thought of it as a lie. Komek got to his feet and walked up the uneven deck toward the back of the ship.
Master!
Laret Sovereign appeared in the doorway, soot staining her face and robes. She was tall for a human female, with striking features and a commanding presence, even at this confusing, difficult moment. Her golden brown eyes met his evenly.
I'm sorry, Padawan Vitus. Your master is again at one with the Force.
Every tenet of Jedi doctrine proclaimed that Komek should feel happy for Master Simix, who had been freed from the illusion of mortality and the weakness of the flesh. Instead, Komek felt as though his guts had been torn out by a rancor's claws. When he shouldered his way past Master Laret, she raised no objection, just let him go. Within a few steps, Komek found Master Simix lying crumpled in one corner. The safety harness aboard this shuttle had not been configured for Philithar or any other limbless species. Simix had laughed about it when they boarded, saying he would take his chances.
Why didn't I insist?
Master Simix, always cautious with the lives of others, had sometimes been careless with his own. More than once, Komek had had to point that out. Generally, it pleased Simix when he did so. He said he'd outsourced his sense of self-preservation to his apprentice. And yet this time, this one fatal time, Komek had let it go.
It was my job to remind him of the risks, Komek told himself as he knelt beside his master's scaly green body and reverently closed his eyes.
It had not been his decision alone to take the T1 shuttle. And yet whatever portion of the blame belonged to him would forever be a heavy weight to bear.
About time something went according to plan,
Isomer growled. Before him glowed the readouts that showed the location of the crashed Jedi vessel. He motioned to two of the guards.
You, get out there. If anyone survived, make sure they don't survive much longer.
This, too, had been foreseen by the Hutts. As they'd explained to Isomer, they wanted the Jedi to travel to that area of space, not merely in search of Force-sensitive infants or on solitary journeys of discovery, but as part of a mission. A mission that would fail terribly. One that would prove to the people of these worlds that neither the distant Republic nor the Jedi could save them. The old hostility toward the Republic seemed to be weakening. The Hutts wanted it strengthened. Then, if these outlanders wanted to conduct commerce with the greater galaxy, they would have to go through the Directorate, and by extension, their new overlords, the Hutts, though Isomer thought less about that aspect of it. Their percentage would be no more than a token, an afterthought. He preferred imagining himself seated among heaped riches, wealthy beyond the dreams of avarice. All he had to do was ensure that nothing stood in the way of the Hutt's plans for mass enslavement. In the prisoner's corner, Monarch Castle ventured under his breath.
I suppose those are our rescuers. Were our rescuers,
Queen Thandeka replied.
Now they're targets. If they survive the crash at all, that is. I've heard the Jedi are very strong,
Castle said, with what sounded like genuine hope.
Perhaps his guards won't be able to destroy them.
Queen Thandeka sighed. The two of them had been huddled together for some time, long enough for her distrust of the Erino ruler to dissipate somewhat.
You're trying to make me feel better.
Castle shrugged and gave her a sheepish smile.
Not sure we could feel much worse.
Thandeka said nothing. It appeared Castle couldn't see as far into the future as she could, a blindness she envied. Because when she projected how this scenario would ultimately play out, Every possible track ended with both of them dead. Orla took Comac's arm as they stumbled out into the frigid, salt-sharpened wind. He had only minor injuries and didn't need the physical support, but no doubt she felt contact with another person might help steady him within. The frenzy of grief he felt reverberated through the Force. He could tell that both Orla and Master Laret sensed it. If one of them dreamed of correcting him, dared to insist that the Jedi should not feel such sorrow, Comac would not be responsible for his actions. However, at the moment, Master Laret remained focused on their goal.
The caves!
She called over the howling gale, gesturing to the vague outline of an entrance farther along the hill.
Let's go!
Together they stumbled through the salt dunes. Comac breathed a sigh of relief when their party finally staggered into the cave. Inside, the stones seemed to have been polished, scoured smooth by centuries of salt, so much so that the cave walls almost looked wet as they glimmered in the light of the Jedi's glow rods. Or maybe not only by salt. As Comac's eyes adjusted to the darkness, he recognized carvings in the walls that depicted a large, hooded serpent. Not a philothar, but enough like one that he had to turn his head away. It was as though Master Simix's portrait had been etched there centuries before to wait for them.
The kidnappers will raid the wreckage soon, Master Laret said. I regret leaving Simix's body behind, but if they find him, they may believe that Simix traveled alone. If so, that buys us time to find the kidnapper's lair.
Comac managed to say,
These carvings. Master Simix said something about them. About serpents playing a large part in the local lore.
He'd been expected to read up on the area's folklore on their journey there. Simix had urged him to do so. Even though legend and myth were interests of Comac's, he'd only skimmed through the reading. They had piloting to do, fighting to anticipate. What were the chances folklore would come into any of that? Or so he'd thought. At the moment, with the carved serpent staring down at him, Comac was not as sure. Orla straightened.
The carvings feel important, like the Force is trying to tell us something. Should we turn back?
Master Laret inclined her head, acknowledging Orla's words without agreeing to them.
To turn back and go elsewhere, we would need somewhere else to go. We have no such place. Our duty is to press forward.
But if...
Orla said, her voice breaking off as they all heard it. A strange sound from deeper within the caves, almost a rustling. No, too heavy for that. She and Comac tensed. Master Laret ahead of them already had her lightsaber in hand and activated it just in time for its blue glow to reveal the enormous white snake, many meters long and more than a meter wide, slithering toward them with its fangs bared. Dez knew the quiet on the station was fragile, that he was needed to patrol and preserve the calm. Yet he had to remain on the vessel for a few moments to try to make some sense of what Comac Vitus was telling him. He asked,
What do you mean you were transported?
Comac shook his head.
I do not mean that my literal location in space changed, but my consciousness was not here. I was someplace dark and terrifying. Staring down into a terrible abyss. My soul ached with a kind of anguish that could have torn it in two. Why, I cannot say, but the pain was very real.
Dez considered this.
You were investigating the ancient artifacts at the time, weren't you?
Comac nodded.
Throughout the galaxy, there have been legends of objects imbued with the dark side. Of amulets and crystals and even glaciers that contained as much malevolence as any living creature. Some said that the most powerful Sith of old were able to do that.
to infuse their own darkness into the objects around them.
Do you think the artifacts could be marked by the dark side in the same way?
Dez asked. Such things are generally no more than legend, Comax said cautiously. But all legend is rooted somewhere in truth. At least one dark side artifact is known to have existed, so we cannot discount the possibility.
If it's not the idols, Dez reasoned, then the darkness has to be emanating from the plants aboard the station.
Comac made a scoffing sound. No, I've encountered trees deep in the dark side before. I know what it feels like. The sensations can be powerful, but this was focused, targeted even. There was intelligence behind it. Dez frowned.
Intelligence? Without a sentient being behind it?
It sounds odd, Comac admitted, but he was deep in thought. But it is possible, especially if...
If what?
Slowly, Comac said, if the idols serve as a kind of warning beacon. If they communicate an intelligent message, namely that we must stay away from the darkness enclosed within them.
At the moment, we're very much not staying away from them,
Dez pointed out.
What do we do?
Nothing. We need some place for everyone to shelter while the hyperspace lanes are closed. This is the only possibility within the system. Comac breathed out heavily, rubbing his temples. Dez took this in.
So you're saying the dark side is present?
And we are trapped here with it. Comac finished.
What can I do?
That was the question Master Jorah had trained Dez to think of first. In this case, however, warnings or no warnings, there wasn't much at all he could do about a vague threat of the dark side's presence. If that darkness made itself manifest, then he'd act. Until then, he'd focus on the tangible aspects of their mission. The memory of Master Jorah made Dez realize what should come next.
Take it easy for a few minutes, he said to Comac, who inclined his head in concession. I've got to find Reef.
Reef had spent the majority of his Padawan training immersed in the archives, but he'd been on rescue missions before. Once, he'd helped clear passengers from a badly malfunctioning transport in the Breeld system. Another time, he had joined a Jedi team assisting in evacuations from a burning tower in Coruscant itself. The second in particular had been difficult, even death-defying. He didn't lack experience. However, he'd never seen, and was convinced he would never see, any group of people so ungrateful for being rescued as the station refugees were. Even many days into their stay on the Amaxine station, they remained as obstreperous and unpleasant as ever.
This you carcass next to meaty scum,
snarled the Arinkan captain.
Then you tell us we have to turn over all our food? Who do you think you are?
A human in a satin and fur cloak stroked his goatee as he proclaimed,
Obviously our passengers paid in advance for the deluxe menu, prepared by our famed chefs with premium ingredients, so we couldn't think of depriving them of what they rightfully purchased.
None of you knows how to share,
retorted Nan, who stood in the middle of them with her arms crossed against her chest. Thanks to her stubborn chin and her diminutive height, she appeared more like a little girl than the young woman she was. The elderly hag behind her kept his hand firmly on her shoulder.
Aren't you ashamed of yourselves?
The Missy Captain looked down his long nose at her.
No.
Everyone needs to stay calm, Reef said for what felt like the 80th time. He stood amid a huddle of most of the passengers, datapad in hand, trying not to show his irritation. Probably that was why Master Comac had stuck him with this task. It was a test of patience. We're all in this together, and we don't know for how long.
We could get the signal to leave in an hour or in 15 months. If you're wasteful or selfish now, there's every chance you're going to regret it severely.
Silence. They didn't look entirely convinced, Reith thought, but at least they'd stopped arguing for a second.
Howdy!
Leox Jossi strolled out of the vessel's airlock door, hands in his pockets, his multicolored beads swaying with each step.
Man, oh man. Gorgeous in here, ain't it? Spectacular. Like an island getaway, except instead of an ocean, we've got open space.
Some of the refugees exchanged glances. This seemed to be a standard reaction to meeting Captain Jossi.
Sure could be stranded a lot worse places than this,
Leox mused as he strolled beneath a thick canopy of leaves. He sniffed a yellow flower and grinned.
Could have been stuck on a desert planet, or a volcanic one, or just dead space, alone, sitting around, wondering if we'd run out of air before we could ever get away.
Reith reflexively took a deep breath. He wasn't the only one who did.
Leox leaned against a tree, mellow and easy.
See, we can look at this one of two ways. One, we didn't get where we wanted to go as fast as we'd like. That's unlucky. Not really that bad in the scheme of things, but unlucky. Or two, while hundreds or thousands of people died in a terrible disaster, we were delivered to safety. Hell, not just safety, but someplace beautiful. That's lucky as all get out, don't you think?
A few people nodded. Nan didn't, but Reith caught the shadow of a smile on her face. Even the Orinkans began to shuffle a bit on their feet as they relaxed their usual battle stances.
So, instead of looking at our little bit of unlucky, I say, let's celebrate the huge amounts of good luck we've had,
Leox said.
We're coming at this from a place of strength. Why not act like it?
The luxury ship captain paused only briefly before saying,
Honestly, most of our meals could be comfortably halved and still provide the nutrition of a meal. We do have some to share.
Not to be outdone, the Mizzy captain chimed in with,
As it happens, we're transporting a shipment of repair parts. Some of them may be of use to those who took damage in hyperspace. Our insurance will cover the losses to our client.
The Orinkan captain grunted, which wasn't exactly a friendly sound, but suggested she and her people would cooperate. After that, Reith was able to put together an overall manifest of food and other meaningful supplies fairly quickly. At the end, as everyone strolled away, he turned to Leox, who was still leaning against the tree.
Thanks. Don't mention it, kiddo. Sometimes we all need a reminder to focus on the good things in life.
Even a few days before, Reith would have been reluctant to believe that he could learn anything, besides basic ship mechanics, from a person like Leox Jossi. He was glad to have discovered differently. As Leox continued his meditative stroll through the greenery, Reith was left alone for the first time since the abortive looting of the Amaxine station. It was an unwelcome solitude. If he didn't have to concentrate on an immediate issue, his mind had time to wander back to the moment he'd faced off with Nan's would-be kidnapper. The sound of the lightsaber, the heavy thud of the severed limb on the floor. Reith was startled out of his reverie by rustling in the ferns, which parted to reveal Dez Rydan stepping through. Dez smiled, but Reith knew why he was there even before Dez said,
How are you feeling?
Shaken, Reith said. Not guilty, exactly, but not guilty either, if that makes sense. I just keep thinking about that moment and wondering if I could have done something differently so that man would still have his arm.
Dez sat cross-legged on a patch of soil. An 8T droid laboring nearby scanned him swiftly, must have determined he posed no risks to any routes, and kept on working.
Probably there was something else you could have done, he said.
Wreath felt it like a lash,
but Dez kept speaking. You don't know what that would have been. Neither do I. In that moment, did you feel like that was necessary in order to rescue Nan?
Yes, otherwise I'd never have done it.
You know, Dez said, every couple of years or so, an apprentice gets into trouble for being too aggressive. Using a lightsaber instead of words. Resorting to action when diplomacy or negotiation would have better resolved the situation. You wouldn't be brought up on that kind of review, Wreath. It was a dangerous moment. The threat was clear. Your response was proportionate to the risk to Nan.
It helped a little to hear Dez say that, but not that much. I keep thinking about it, replaying it over and over in my head, trying to think of a different way it could have ended.
Good. It takes strength to question your own actions. Just don't dwell on the past to the point of forgetting the present.
Wreath managed a crooked smile.
You're good at this.
Tell Master Jorah that sometime.
Dez grinned back.
She won't believe it.
Already Wreath's spirits had improved. The weight of what he had done would linger, but only in the ways that would help him learn from the experience. Still, he couldn't stop wondering. That guy. The one I... How is he?
Dez replied, oh, he'll live. Unless Orla Jareni finishes him off.
It's a clean severing, right at the joint so you can move to a prosthetic quickly. And the wound was instantly cauterized,
Orla said as she saw the painkillers finally taking full effect on the red-scarved man.
You don't have to worry about infection.
Infection's not what I'm worried about. I've lost my arm, the man bellowed.
Full consciousness had returned, with fury not far behind.
You Jedi are responsible for this, just as you are responsible for the attempted abduction of a young woman.
Orla got to her feet, taking care with the small confines of the vessel's utility bay and making no effort to disguise the contempt in her voice.
You were warned to stop. You could have stopped, but you chose not to, because you thought a Jedi Padawan wouldn't be able to prevent you from stealing the girl. You're reaping the consequences of being very, very wrong about that.
The man knew he was guilty, obviously, but he was unwilling to let go of what he considered the righteousness of his wrath.
Don't get all high and mighty with me! Don't the Jedi abduct children, too?
It took all Orla's training to cast that flash of anger aside.
Families willingly give their Force-sensitive children to the temples so that they can be trained in the ways of the Jedi. It's their free choice.
She took a deep breath in an attempt to calm herself. It only partly worked.
For future reference, when a young girl's screaming for you to let her go, she gets a free choice, too. If you ignore that, then you can't complain about the results. Now, assemble your crew and get your ship away from this station within the hour, or we'll do that for you.
The red-scarved man blanched.
You'd cut us off from air? From food?
You've surely recirculated enough air by now to breathe for a few weeks. We won't let you starve, but we also won't allow kidnappers to roam freely.
Orla snapped the med pack shut.
In other words, get out.
Once the criminal vessel had detached itself from the station and an orderly division of goods was underway, Comac Vitus felt he could spare a few minutes to center himself. The ominous darkness aboard the station continued to trouble him, but in order to explore that more fully, he needed his strength in the Force. Meditation was a necessary prelude to action. Carefully, he noted the positions of every other person assigned to the vessel. Wreath and Dez on the station with Leox, Orla in the mess, Affy resting in her bunk, Geode, apparently in charge of the bridge, before seeking a place of quiet and privacy. He found it in the very back of the ship, in front of a sealed-off cargo container. Interesting that the vessel crew would apologize so often for the smallness of their makeshift quarters, while still reserving so much space for cargo they hadn't even mentioned. Comac laid down his heavy blanket, folded into a kind of meditation mat, then knelt on it.
I behold the world within myself,
he thought.
I behold the world without myself.
The mantra had helped soothe him for many years. He liked the balance of it, but it had become too literal now to serve as a mantra.
I am a Jedi. I have always been one. It is my identity, one I have never sought to change. But the Order does not answer the questions that linger within me. The questions only grow over time. Darkness abides upon this station. It is too familiar to me now. But the shape it takes here is different and unsettling. Consciousness without a corporeal being. What created this? How did the dark side take form in this place? How does the dark side take form anywhere? Sometimes I think we, the Jedi, must be somehow to blame. We who refuse to look at the Force in full, to examine the darkness as well as the light.
If the dark side were not so alien to them, Comac suspected, they would more readily understand the nature of the idols.
How can we split the Force in two? How can we justify such an act of violence? And it is violence, such a dividing. Even the darkness divided from the light.
Affy gave Leox all the credit for getting their fellow refugees to calm down, but she had to admit the Jedi were quick to give everyone a common goal, namely penetrating the lower rings of the station. That goal happened to neatly match her own. They'd accepted her report on the upper rings easily enough, which was fine because her report was true. It was not, however, the whole truth. Affy was keeping the smuggler's code and her thoughts about it to herself for the time being. It makes zero sense for this to be a regular Bind Guild portal, she reasoned as she prepared to head down to the lower rings with the rest of the volunteers. Wreath, Nan, Dez, and a long-limbed Mizzy who, like all Mizzy, preferred to be nameless to strangers.
It's out of the way, and it doesn't have any obvious advantages.
But what if there's a secret society within the guild, one that's operating behind Scover's back?
They could be skimming off the top, stealing small amounts of cargo or money, falsifying records to hide it from management.
The pre-programmed location could have been downloaded from another ship, one that's in on it. She didn't have to ask whether Leox was in on it. He would never. As angry as that theory made Affy, it was by far the most plausible she'd come up with. Scover wouldn't hide something like this from her, so somebody had to be hiding things from Scover. Her chest swelled with pride as she imagined finding the proof, presenting it to Scover, hearing her say, "Well done, daughter."
"All right," said Dez Rydan, bringing her back to the present.
The scouting party stood around him near the entrance to the lower ring. They all wore their own versions of utility gear, except for the Jedi, whose workaday garb seemed good for all occasions.
"We can't get any specific readings on what might be down there, only that it's not solid metal. If it's storage, there may be items of use to us, which will be equally shared among the entire group. As long as everyone understands that and accepts the risks, let's get started."
"Should you do this?"
Wreath quietly asked Nan, who barely came up to the Mizzy's waist.
"I'm fine,"
Nan retorted. She showed no signs of trauma from the kidnapping attempt. Affy wasn't sure she could be equally cool under those circumstances.
"Besides, Haig can't climb. One of us should be here, so it's got to be me."
"You take good care of him," Wreath said. Nan smiled.
"He returns the favor."
Enough flirtation theater. Affy refocused her attention on the tunnels that led to the lower rings. Unlike all the other tunnels, these showed signs of damage from their long years of disuse. While the other structure remained intact, vines and roots from the arboretum had grown down through them, turning what had been clear passageways into thick, thorny mazes deep in shadow. It wasn't anything Affy could have explored on her own. She'd have preferred it that way, in case more of the smuggler's code was written down there. However, the twisty tunnels were ominous enough that she could see the upside of having company along for the trip. Dez took the lead, lowering himself through the tunnel. Its gravity was on the fritz, which meant the pull was coming from the rings below. Luckily, the craggy roots served as a makeshift ladder. Affy gripped on tightly as she lowered herself down. For a few seconds, she was surrounded by both tree roots and a vast field of stars, a contrast that delighted her in its strangeness. No time to linger and enjoy it, though. The Mizzy above her was in a hurry to descend, so much so that he was cutting away vines to clear his path even farther. She heard the beeps and whines of a droid. Glancing upward, she saw an AT scooting along, its treads gripping the outer wall of the tunnel. Huh, she thought. Those things are thorough. A snap echoed through the tunnel, and Wreath made a sound of discomfort. Peering down, Affy could see that his foot had gone straight through a slender root. No big deal. Or so Affy thought, until the AT whirred past her toward Wreath, then hit him with an electric shock. Ow! Wreath shook his hand as though it stung. What the... The Mizzy yelped in pain. Affy looked up to see another AT extending pincers toward the Mizzy, snapping at his fingers. Farther up the tunnel, at least three more ATs were descending toward them. She could hardly believe it, but there was no other explanation. We're being attacked!
I'm jumping June bugs. That part made the hair on my neck stand up. It was that intense. So we've been through the ringer with Into the Dark. Our characters are going through some stuff. They're shining a light on the courage and determination that lies within. But I think this would be a great time to get to the quote. And this episode's quote comes to us from Elena V. Quinn. She said, "Dreams don't work unless you do. Act, endure, and surpass." So what does this mean? Think about dreams as seeds. You got this packet full of seeds, which are your dreams. Big ones, like owning a house. Or smaller ones, like learning to bake a perfect loaf of bread. Now, just having the seeds won't get you a garden. You gotta plant them, water them, sometimes fend off pests, and keep at it, even when it seems like nothing is sprouting. This quote is pretty much saying that dreams are just a starting point. For them to become real, you gotta put in the work. Acting means taking the first steps. Like if your dream is to get fit, you start by going for a run. Enduring means keeping at it, even when your muscles are sore, or you'd rather be binge watching your favorite TV show. And surpassing, that's when you beat your personal best, running faster than you thought you could. Applying this to real life means recognizing that your dreams are not going to just happen by wishing. Say your dream is to start your own business. It starts with an idea. But to make it real, you gotta research, plan, find funding, work long hours, face setbacks, and aiming to surpass your own expectations. So dreams, they're beautiful and inspiring, but they're just the blueprints. Building them into reality requires effort, resilience, and determination to go beyond what you initially thought possible. It's about rolling up your sleeves and getting down to work, facing challenges head on, and pushing yourself to new heights. And that's our thoughts on part four. Thanks for riding along with me on this galactic journey. I'm eager to see how our characters keep going and turning the tides in their own battles. More battles coming your way in just a few days. So until then, may the Force be with you. Thank you for listening to Star Wars Audio Archives. Join us next time for more Star Wars adventures. If you would like to listen to other episodes of the show, you can follow us on your favorite podcast directory. If you enjoyed the show, we would greatly appreciate a 5-star review. Once again, thank you for listening, and may the Force be with you. Sway was created by Kenai Shedd and is a production of Pick Film Media. This show was produced by Quinn McDaniel and was distributed by Swaycast Network. Star Wars was read to you by Jason Odega. Sound design by Theodore Thompson. I am your host, Kyle, and we will see you next time in a galaxy far, far away.